Today I would like, my topic today, actually my title would be Remembering the Sabbath Day to Keep It Holy. And I'm looking at some interesting people that have been around for a long time. And it's not like, okay, you haven't heard sermons on the Sabbath, but I look back on many of my records that I've kept, and I don't think I've given a Sabbath sermon here in a long time. So I've given one on the holy days and things of that nature, but I'd like to talk about an aspect of the Sabbath day today. Let me just ask you this, knowing again the nature of how we are and what we do, and it gives us some consideration to take a look at our application to the Sabbath. For many years, we have been observing the Sabbath day, and there comes a time to reflect on God's purpose for this day and to examine ourselves as our approach and thinking regarding the Sabbath. I'd like to even ask here, since sunset that began this special day, how many of us have really been able to rest? It's almost like it takes us an entire Sabbath day to prepare to rest, and then we're back into the grind again. History reveals that there have always been Sabbath keepers, yet the battle to disregard this special day has certainly taken its toll on the entire world, and some of my notes here go again to so many comments that have been made concerning the changing of the Sabbath day, back to even other ministers talking about the Bible, and it says that there was one that was an article written by Joe Kovacs. I think it was dated back in 2000. It's buried in my articles here somewhere, but he offered $1,000. You probably remember that, to anybody that can show him in the Bible that it says that the Sabbath day is Sunday. So he actually put that on the internet, and nobody's been able to take that $1,000 home, because most will acknowledge that the Bible doesn't say anything about that. Some will say, well, because of Christ's resurrection on Sunday, that's why we keep it on Sunday. And that's basically one of the reasons that you'll get when people say it's been changed. They'll also go to one scripture in Revelation where it talks about on the Lord's Day, and one scripture they use to change the Sabbath day to Sunday. So that's not my purpose today. If I did have a little time, I could read some of that to you, but I want to look at more of an application again and how we look at this. You know, we understand that the one behind this spiritual battle to change this day has always been the prime distorter of God's laws, the one to whom the book of Revelation reveals as the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And when you think about that and step back from this day, most of the world has been deceived when it comes to this. It's so interesting how so many could be deceived on something that's so provable that the Bible doesn't change that day at all, and there's no proof to that at all. But it's commonly accepted just because someone says that, but actually to be able to go to the Bible and approve it, people can't do it, and there was a man that came out, offered $1,000 to anybody that could. So what's it mean for us? Let's take a look at this crucial law and strengthen our foundational belief in the importance and relevance of this commandment. What does it mean for us today to remember the Sabbath day and to keep it holy? I'd like first to go back to Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 1, where it all began here, and to ask a couple questions here. In Genesis 1, in fact, I do have within this a little chart, probably from, this looks like the old lesson series from the Worldwide Church of God, lesson 24, so it's got to be one of the Bible correspondence courses. This was lesson 24, and at the very top of it, it lists the first seven-day week. And it goes through, as you can read from chapter 1, in verse 1 through verse 30. Here it speaks of, in these days here, Sunday, there was light that appeared on the earth. We know it was a recreation at that time, so whatever devastation was caused, God caused the light to once again appear. So you had to take all that smoke and vapor, whatever it was, to clear the way for light to appear on the earth, and obviously to have things start to grow. Without light, that wouldn't be possible. So something that these are not really literal days. This is what it says. This is what we've all believed, and God is certainly able to make things come up in one day. So on Sunday, the light appeared. On the second day, he divided the waters. So he created the lakes, the oceans, everything that he had as planned. And the thing is, sometimes we look over this so fast, just like we do a Sabbath day, And when I think of waters being divided, I'm thinking of, you know, we have tags and we've got names for them now. We've got the Black Sea, we've got the Atlantic, we've got the Pacific, and they're all different. And God caused that to happen. In fact, we'll go a little bit into a little bit more detail on this, which he does in another book. Waters were divided. On Tuesday, the dry land appears and vegetation was created. So, you know, how do you do this? That's another question that I have. It's such a short verse when you look at this, but all the vegetation. How long did it take him to come up with all this? Because we're trying to plant in our garden now. I don't know vegetation that well. So, but you try to plant something, and we are talking to a gardener at Lowe's, and the gardeners that know their stuff, they just will kind of crack you up because they're kind of thinking, well, just plant that over there. And I'm going, there's more to me than just planting, because when I plant something, it usually dies. You know, I don't know how to plant very well, but they're kind of like, oh, just dig the hole, put it in there, put some, you know, they do say put a little bit of fertilizer in there. Of course, that makes sense. You know, and just, you know, water it a little bit and leave it go. This time of year, it's a little bit different because things are going dormant now. So there's a little bit of information that one needs on that. But there's all kinds of what I'm fascinated with, because I did work with a landscaper who was able to match up colors and grasses and all different things that would come up at different times. So there's always something interesting in the garden that would be taking place. When one thing went down, another thing would be coming up. And that, to me, is really fascinating. But the fascinating thing is, it's God that made all these. He created all these plants, all the flowers, all the vegetation. This is something that's pretty noteworthy, but we just get a statement, vegetation is created. This is a lot of stuff that was made, and a lot of planning went behind this. Now, on Wednesday, it says the sun, moon, and stars become visible. On Thursday, the sea life and birds were created, so now you've got the animal kingdom coming into play, because now you also have grasses and the other vegetation that are going to be able to feed these animals the way that God made it to be. So you can see kind of it makes sense the way it all came into order. On Friday, the land animals and man were created. And then, of course, on Sabbath, on Saturday, the Sabbath was notated or made to be. The interesting thing about this now is we get this these verses. Let me just show you. If you go to chapter 1, I want you to take a look at verse 4 first. Just to yourselves, read verse 4. And now, if you're finished with that, read verse 10. Just kind of do maybe a quick scan to it if you want. And go ahead and read verse 12. And tell me when, kind of raise your hand if what you're seeing, something in common in these verses. What are you seeing that's in common? Okay, we've got one that's got it so far. Verse 12, then verse 18. Got another one here. So that's two that grab it so far. Verse 21. Got it? I think everybody has it. Verse 25, and finally in verse 31. Verse 31. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. This is what I believe that we miss sometimes. Because if we're supposed to be taking on the nature of God and being like God, I wonder how many of us will do something because God designed us to be creators. And we've made a lot of things. We've constructed a lot of things. And we took one portion of our garden that's been overcome by some grasses and things like that. We took a chunk of that. And we pulled some old stuff out, put some new stuff in. It remains to be seen what's going to happen. We'll probably have to wait till spring now. But just stopping and taking a look at that. How many of us really do that? That you finish up a project, we step back from it and go, wow, that was really neat. You know, we're coming up to Thanksgiving. I know when the women slave, sometimes the guys too will help out, but mostly the women will prepare these meals. Would it take so much time to go ahead and get a turkey, to prepare it, do all the things and the many different ways that that's done, and all the different foods that will go along with that, and all the preparations? You know something? It's eaten so fast. It's just like all the time you wish you could stretch that out and maybe let it last a little bit longer. Because all the preparation, all the table is looking good. And it's all the table settings are there. You sit down, boom, it's gone. And pretty much the guys go watch their football games and talk. That's common pretty much in the United States now. But you know, nice to just stop sometimes and say, you know, could we say the same thing? That was good. You know, I like what I just did there. Sometimes I know when I've cut grass, just starting that process now, in the past month since obtaining our home, because I know back in Georgia, I used to like to finish cutting the grass, and then I would sit out in the front porch. I would just look at it for a while. I just said, you know, it really looks nice when a lawn is freshly cut and trimmed. Do we ever stop, though, to do that? And I think the danger part here is it goes by so quick, because I know the Sabbath goes by very fast. So are we actually able to stop and really reflect just like God did? You know, at the end of these days, when he made all this stuff, he stopped, and I don't know if he folded his arms or whatever, but you're kind of looking back and going, that is really good. Next day he makes something. That's really good. I really like that. You know, you see the way that sun shines. You know, did he look at that? I love the way, because we'll acknowledge that, especially during this time of the years. We'll come through the mountains and we'll go, wow, look at that tree color. It's beautiful. Look at all the colors. This is the stuff that God designed. I'm sure that he stopped and looked at that and go, you know, I like my design there. You know, all the intricacies that go into that, because obviously we know that the trees fall to the ground, they become mulch, and they fertilize the ground. Everything that he made makes sense. And yet, just contained in these short verses is his entire creation. I just wonder sometimes if we stop long enough to even think about that. That's one thing I'd like to help us with in the coming days and weeks, that we stop for a little bit. Stop and take a look at the importance of what we're accomplishing and why we're accomplishing, because God reflected on the work that he had done. And Genesis chapter 2 now, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 1. Here it says, thus the heavens and earth were finished, and all the host of them. So it wasn't just this, we're going to see a little bit more. If it wasn't just the earthly things that he had accomplished. It says, thus the heavens and earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended, or you can look into this, he ceased his work which he had made, and he rested. The big question that comes up, was he tired? And so we look a little bit more into this word, into the, you know, I mean, did he have the sweat of his brow or anything? I don't think that obviously we can look at God physically in that way. That this is not the rest that we would be talking about of resting, that we really are just all tired out. The word here is actually called Shabbat, but it's only one B. It's S-H-A-B-A-T-H. It's from the Hebrew. It's interesting, the number here is attached to 7673. So he desisted. You could use that word in there from the definition rendered in the concordance. It's very close, by the way, to Sabbath or Shabbat, which is the Hebrew 7676. So you're only three away from this other word. It actually says intensive. When it renders the word Shabbat or Sabbath, it says intensive from 7673. So it's derived from that word, evidently. In my limited Hebrew knowledge, but here this word Sabbath is also rendered intermission. Intermission. We always think of intermissions. Yes, we're having an intermission right now before we go into the rest of the play. It's a stoppage period. It's a time where he stopped from all the work that he had done. And so what he did, he says in verse 3, he blessed the seventh day and he sanctified it, or he set it apart, because he stopped from all his work which God created and made. And the big question to ask again, why was this? Why did he set this day apart and say, I'm stopping it? There was a plan here. He made a seven-day week, and he said, those 6 days, I'm going to work. seventh day, I'm going to stop. We've changed that a little bit, obviously, in our day and age today, to where we actually went a little bit more than that. We actually have done, for knowledge of my parents, my dad always had a five-day work week. Weekends you had off. That's typical. Not so typical anymore. And I'd like to read from an article that somebody looks at it in this way. So what we can receive from these verses is something that we may be overlooking in our lives today. When do we really cease from work? Are we really able to put it away? Or does it come up, I've got to do this, I've got to do this. My list of to-do is very long. But we got our lists going. How, can we ever stop our minds and think about something that we just did instead of running to the next one and to the next one? And as I was told some years ago, your work will never be accomplished. I know some of the women have that hanging in their kitchen. A woman's work is never done. True, and that's the same case for a man. I understand from the woman's point, because you fix a meal, you wash the dishes, then you've got to fix it again, wash the dishes, and the cycle goes on. But in many cases, that's the way it is in a man's life too. So we're all in the same boat. But when do we really cease from our work? Do we really take a look or regard our labor? Are we able to say, and Eric saw that it was really good? Eric cut the trees, trimmed the hedges, and saw that it was really good. What's the purpose otherwise? Why do we even do it if we can't stop back and take a look and enjoy it? Over in Job 38, we find the insights of God's creation revealed. And he brought it to mind, obviously, in a time where Job had ears to hear, reflecting on the whys of his life, what life was all about. I'm going through in depth of a wrong type of teaching, obviously, wrong information from his three friends, but a lot learned out of some wrong information. But here in verse 1, the Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man, I will question you, and you will answer me." And now he goes into this. He goes into more depth than given in Genesis chapter 1. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Do any of us?" How did he do that? How do you set the earth in a perfect motion on the perfect tilt within the exact range of the sun where it needs to be? I was told some years ago, I can't remember exactly what it was, but if the earth was so much closer to the sun, we'd be burned out of existence. It's perfect exactly where it is. With gravitational pulls and everything, how do you do that? It's hard to figure that out. We just look at it, we go, oh, okay, that's the way it is. And somebody comes up with a concept, there was a big bang that blew up, and everything just got there, which is such ridiculous thinking when you see how God does things and how he plans things. But look, he goes into more depth. Who determined its size, its measurements? Who determined that it would be circular and the dimensions would be so big and this is the way I'm going to do it? This takes thinking and planning. He says, "Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Now you know, you see some more into this creation. That there was a time here when God finished it and said it was good, and the angelic realm was shouting for joy because of the knowledge of what God's going to do with this plan and put it together. How beautiful it must have been for the angelic realm to take a look at this creation, because they were not given the ability to create, only God did it. He made everything. So they're looking at this and they're going, wow. And sometimes we get those wows. You know, I got wows when I would go to the top of the mountain in Colorado and I'd look over, I'd go, this is gorgeous. Or the aspens over in Park City, Utah. Or sometimes as we look at the oceans or the way that the palm trees are made and the coconuts and all the different things in the different places that we see. that are absolutely brilliant and gorgeous, or to dive down near a reef if you're in the ocean and get to do some snorkeling or diving and seeing all the types of fish. Our last dive that we went through, the snorkeling in Fiji, I saw fish that I've never seen before. And so we're constantly finding out and seeing new things that God has made in all different designs, and sometimes so interesting. The one fish that has a little thing that goes down before it that attracts other fish. You know, it shows God's creativity, sometimes His humor in the way that He does things, in the way that He makes things. You know, blowfish, clownfish, all kinds of things. And that's just parts of the things that He had made. He says, "Who shut the sea with its doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band?" How did God do that when He flooded the entire earth? It says He opened up the fountains of the earth. Evidently, there was enough water in the earth to flood the entire earth. Or did He have to make more? Very interesting. Does God ever make more water? You know, we're probably drinking the same water that David and they all drank before. It's the same stuff. God just takes it through His own process to clean it and put it back down to this earth. He doesn't need the reverse osmosis machines. How does He do this? He made it to be this way. Sometimes we don't stop long enough to even think about that. We go too fast. But look what He says here. And Job, again, was obviously very attentive when he says this. "When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, 'This is the farthest you may come, but no farther, and here your proud waves must stop.'" Isn't it interesting the way that God put it? He says, that's it. That's the limit to the ocean. That's as far as you're going to go. I've set your limits. This is what God did. "Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place?" Every morning we get up, and if you could see the sun coming up, that's kind of a neat thing to do sometimes. We did that when we went to the Sinai, or it was supposedly was Mount Sinai, climbed to the top of Mount Sinai, and the neat thing to do, what they try to do is we actually were climbing at about 3 in the morning. So by the time you got up to the top, you could see the sun come up. It was absolutely beautiful, just gorgeous. And sometimes some of us have seen these sunrises come up and the sun sets. He's going, "Have you considered this? Did you realize how this came to be? Cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold to the ends of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it. And it takes on form like clay under a seal." What he's saying is the sun comes up and all the bad people go into hiding, because now you can see what they're doing. "It takes on form like clay under a seal. It stands out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Have you entered the springs of the sea? Or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this." No, Job here was Ralph Cramden. Hama, hama, hama. What could you say? What could you say to something like that? "Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths of its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? Have you entered into the," look how he says this, "the treasury of snow?" I once dumped a bank account on one of my friends. He was standing under the tree. I was going to take a picture of him, and I just bumped. Probably some of you have done that. Just bump the trunk of the tree. And all of a sudden, the bank account of snow comes down and hits him over the head. You've seen that, how it gathers onto the trees and what we can do with snow. "Have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and to cause spring to forth growth of the tender grass?" You've probably seen this when you've seen the animal kingdoms or something, as you look over Africa and you see the barren desert and the animals going from place to place trying to find food and awaiting that time to where that Serengeti or the grass will eventually be watered again. Then you see all of a sudden what was a dry bed, arid with no water, and you see the water come over it, and all of a sudden these living things start to come out of the ground again. They went back into the ground in dormancy while that took place. How would God even think of doing something like that? He didn't miss anything. When you think of all the ideas and the concepts of what he has done. So he goes through this. Has the rain a father? Or who begat the drops of dew? From whose womb does the ice come from and the frost of heaven? It gives its birth. The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. We take that for granted. Summer, we swim in it. In the winter, you don't want to dive onto that. Some people have found out the hard way. But he made, this goes in. Now we take it further because of our creative capability. We've been able to look at what God's made and kind of figure out things. We call it H2O, or when one molecule of this or one molecule of that, but mankind has just attached numbers and identified what God has already done. He says, can you bind the cluster of Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? He was bringing up names that he was calling these galaxies and stars out there, naming them. Or loose the belt of Orion. Can you bring out Mazareth in its season? Can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the mind or given understanding into the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom or pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clouds cling together? Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food to the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? All this thing God has had in his planning. And here we are about in such a busy time in our lives, when sometimes maybe the Spirit of God within us cries out to go, stop. Stop and take a look at this for a while and see what this is all about. This is partially what the Sabbath is all about. Because in thinking about this, in acknowledging that God made this, it's a part of our worship to God to thank Him for what He has done for all of mankind and what He intends to do in the future. Now, before I go too fast through this, I'd like to bring a little article up here. This is actually goes back to March 2003. Her name is Judith Shulevitz. She brings back a focus, a Sabbath keeper maybe in a different way, not as we keep it, but a different focus on it nonetheless that I'd like to take a look at. She says, Sandor Ferenczi, a disciple of Freud's, once identified a disorder he called Sunday neurosis. Every Sunday, or in the case of a Jewish patient, every Saturday, the Sunday neurotic developed a headache or a stomach ache or an attack of depression. After ruling out purely physiological causes, including the rich food served at Sunday dinners, Ferenczi figured out what was bothering his patients. They were suffering from the Sabbath. On that weekly holiday observed by all present-day civilized humanity, Ferenczi was writing in 1919 when Sunday was still being kept, even in Budapest, his hometown, not only did drudgery give way to festivity, family gatherings, and occasionally worship, but the machinery of self-censorship shut down too, stilling the eternal murmur of self-reproach. The Sunday neurotic, rather than enjoying his respite, became distraught. He feared that impulses repressed only with great effort might be unleashed. He induced pain or mental anguish to preempt the feeling of being out of control. Now, when I look at these paragraphs, I'm asking that you would evaluate these two to see what's wrong with this? And how does this maybe apply to my life? Because what happens, we get such in a frenzy of 6 days of working and doing things that we get to the Sabbath day, we don't even know what to do. We're not used to it. It's hard for us to slow down. It's even hard for us to think or not think. Put it that way, maybe not think. About a decade ago, she says, I developed a full-blown weekend disorder of my own. Perhaps because I am Jewish, it came on Friday nights. My mood would darken until by Saturday afternoon I'd be unresponsive and morose. My normal routine, which involved brunch with friends and swapping tales of misadventure and the relentless quest for romance and professional success, made me feel impossibly restless. I started spending Saturdays by myself. After a while, I got lonely and did something that, as a teenager profoundly put off by her religious education, I could never have imagined wanting to do. I began dropping in at a nearby synagogue. It was a small building in Brooklyn, self-consciously built nearly a century ago to look European. It had served as a set in an adventurously hilarious movie. I sat in the back of this Disney-fied sanctuary and discovered that I had no interest in praying, which I hardly remembered how to do. What I wanted to do was listen to the hymns, which offered the uncanny comfort of songs heard in childhood. And it's interesting now, as I try to match this up with today, today what you get, people want to go to church to listen to music. And that's why you get all of the different drum sets and all of the different guitars. Do they really come because they want to worship God or because they want to be entertained? Because nowadays you've got churches that have yoga classes for women. You've got churches that have workout rooms for the guys. So see, you can actually come to a church now and get something out of it, if you don't, especially if you don't like the sermon. Or if the sermon's too long, just go back to the weight room. Or maybe a swimming pool. She continues, it was only much later, after I joined the synagogue and changed my life in a million other unforeseen ways, that I developed a theory about my condition. If Ferenczi's patients had suffered from the Sabbath, I was suffering from the lack thereof. In the Darwinian world of New York, 20-something, everything, even socializing, reading, or exercising felt like work or in the pursuit of work by other means. Had I been able to consult Ferenczi, I believe he would have told me that I was experiencing the painful inklings of sanity. See, because what they were doing is being so out of touch with the reality of what God had made, that actually to come into a reality of keeping a Sabbath day bothered people. Because they don't know what to do. I got to fellowship with people? I've got to talk? I have to actually come up and think about conversation that might have to do with God instead of socializing? Because it's a lot easier to talk about a football game or something else that's transpired during the week or part of your work or your job. It comes more natural than coming into a Sabbath service and, why do I really have to talk about God? What do I even talk about? How do I talk about that? And it's foreign to people. She continues, for in the 84 years since Ferenczi identified the syndrome, which bears a striking resemblance to now what is called workaholism, it has become the norm. And the Sabbath, the one day in seven dedicated to rest by divine command, has become the holiday Americans are most likely never to take. It's too uncomfortable for them. They can get more done by working. It's accomplishing something, as she'll point out. It can be startling to realize just how integral the Sabbath once was to American time. When we tell our children stories about the first pilgrims landing on our shores, we talk rather vaguely about their quest for religious freedom. We leave out that this freedom was needed in large part so the Puritans could obey the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, with a zealotry that had deeply alienated their countrymen back home. We have all heard of the Puritan, quote, blue laws, unquote, namely, supposedly, for the color of paper they were printed on. They required attendance at church, but punished anyone who got there with an unseemly haste or on too showy a horse. They forbade unnecessary visiting, except in emergencies, and smoking and sports. Unlike Orthodox Jews, who, though strict about the Sabbath, are nonetheless encouraged to drink and have marital sex on Friday night, the ascetic Puritans frowned on any kind of drinking or sex on Sunday. In at least one documented instance, the lewd and unseemly behavior of kissing your wife on your doorstep upon returning home from the journey of 3 years was punished by a spell in the stocks. From sunset Saturday to sunset Sunday, the most pious Sabbatarians, usually clergymen, wouldn't shave, have their rooms swept or beds made, or allowed food to be prepared or dishes washed. They ate only what had been cooked in advance and devoted all time not spent in church to reading Scripture. See, what I'm showing here is what typically mankind has done. And it got to a point in our modern day and age to where the Sabbath wasn't being kept appropriately, people saw hypocrisy, and enough people got turned off that they went totally the other way by now claiming that there is no Sabbath once again, and you can pretty much do whatever you want as long as you honor God on any day of the week. It's always taken this approach. Jesus is pointing this out here. Even after Puritanism lost its hold on American culture, the American Sunday was observed with unusual strictness. In 1831, Alexis de Tocqueville observed with some surprise that few Americans were permitted to go on a hunt, to dance, or even to play an instrument on. Some of that, as you know, has been carried over. Some groups don't believe that you should play music or even play a musical instrument. So you go all that way to the other way of having full-fledged rock and roll bands that call themselves Christian rock groups. And so that's an attraction to some. As recently as 125 years ago, you would have been hard-pressed to find a museum or library open on Sunday. 80 years ago, football was considered too vulgar to be played on Sunday. Look what's happened to that. Oldsters remember standing in line at the bank on Fridays to get cash for the weekend. Anybody old enough to remember that? I don't. But evidently, this has happened. Youngsters assume that they can withdraw at will. Anyone older than 30 can remember living with the expectation that most stores would be closed on Sunday. That was the case. I do remember that. The expectation now is they will be open, and we're miffed when they're not. The Lonely Days Were Sundays is the title of a book about growing up Jewish in a church going south. The Lonely Sunday has been replaced by the overscheduled Sunday, Soccer Sunday, Little League Sunday, Yoga Class Sunday, Catch Up Around the House Sunday. Americans still go to church, of course, but only in between chores, sporting events, and shopping expeditions. You can now find ATM machines inside megachurches. Congregants don't have to waste a minute between services in the mall. Very interesting. The eclipse of the Sabbath is just one part of any larger erosion of social time with its formerly generally agreed upon rhythms of labor and repose. After hours has become strictly a personal concept since 24-hour convenience store, gas station, pharmacy, supermarket, movie theater, diner, factory, and bar all allow us to work, shop, dine, and be entertained at any time of day or night. We greet each shift of an activity from weekday or evening or weekend as a proof of American cultural superiority. We knock over the barriers between us and the perpetual motion machine that is the marketplace with the glee you might expect of insomniacs who have been chained too long, for too long to their beds. The lingering traces of Sabbatarianism seem comical, like the New York Blue Law that won't let you buy beer until afternoon on Sunday. Broadway stages that go dark on Sunday nights, work rules requiring us to show up at our offices Monday through Friday, even though many of us do our best to work at night or on weekends, and as you've seen from the movie Office Space, putting in the face time at office is offering a cover for doing less. Customs exist because they answer a need. When they disappear, that need must be met in some other way. So what she's looking at is the element of the Sabbath, what's happened to it. What I try to do is look at this and regard it to how is this affecting us? Because obviously we don't do Sunday, we do the Sabbath. But when you're looking at everything that happens in society and we're trying to evaluate this, some of that can creep up in our lives too. We get so caught up and so busy that we acknowledge the Sabbath, we wouldn't be here if we didn't. But my question is, how are we looking at this? And what can we do to make some changes? She goes on in many different ways on this. To point out what's being done and what's being said in today's society today. She points out here, and there are important ways in even which in our impressive recreational creativity, fails to reproduce the benefits of the Sabbath. Few elective activities will ever rise to a status higher than our work and our minds, and therefore cannot be relied on to counterbalance our neurotic drive to achieve. Most of us will jettison plans to go skiing if a deadline looms near. We will assign a high priority to a non-work-related hobby only if we have committed to do it in some public manner, as we do when we join a volleyball team or a choir. And not even our group leisure activities can do for us what the Sabbath rituals could once be counted on to do. Religious rituals do not exist simply to promote togetherness. They're theater. They're designed to convey to us a story about who we are without even quite noticing what they are doing. One defining feature of religious rituals, in fact, is that we often perform them for years before we come to understand what they really mean. This is why ministers and rabbis are famously unsympathetic when congregants complain that worship services or holiday rites feel meaningless. The story told by the Sabbath is that of creation. We rest because God created on the seventh day. What leads from God to humankind is the notion that the imitation of God, in other words, we rest in order to honor the divine in us. See where she goes off in here. You know, you can tell she writes a little bit more complicated, a little bit more college educated from that point of view. It's not really an easy read, but she says to remind ourselves that there is more to us than just what we're doing during the week. That part is right, but we do come together to honor and to worship God and think about what he has done and think about that creation. She says, talk of God may disturb the secular, so they might prefer to frame the Sabbath in the more neutral context of ascetics. The Sabbath provides two things essential to anyone who wishes to lift himself out of the today's day and age: time to contemplate and distance from everyday demands. The Sabbath is to the weak what the line break is to poetic language. It's the silence that forces you to return to what came before to find its meaning. And so God stopped, and that's what he said. What have I? Look at what I've done. And sometimes that's what we have to take a look at to enjoy this and to really capture what the Sabbath is for us all as well. To finish this up here, because it's a longer article, I'm just trying to take some excerpts here. Social legislating mandating Sunday or Saturday closings is no longer viable. Besides, it seems arrogant to tell someone what keeping the Sabbath would do for him, because it's impossible to know how a ritual will affect a person until he's performed it. Holy days, rituals, liturgies, all like musical notations which in themselves cannot convey the nuances and textures of life for performance. Whenever I dream of living in a society with a greater respect for the Sabbatarian past, a fantasy I entertain only with anxiety, since Sabbatarians have a long history of going too far, I think of something two rabbis said. Rabbi Judah Loew of Prague, best known for his Tales of the Golem, it's called, pointed out that the story of creation was written in such a way that each day, each new creation is seen as a step toward a completion that occurred on the Sabbath. And if you remember what I pointed out, he made things in such an order that step had to be a process before the next one could be done. You couldn't put the vegetation on the earth until you cleared out so the sun could shine. You had to have water. You had to have all the things in place. Could God have done it another way? Yes, he could. But he showed through his creation that there's an order to everything. And he stopped and he thought about it. He said, this is good. What we can be missing out in our lives is we go too fast, that we forget even what we do and how we do it. It goes too quick. What was creation's climatic culmination? The act of stopping. And that's where they get this right. The act of stopping. God stopped. Why should God have considered it so important to stop? Rabbi Elijah of Vilna put it this way. God stopped to show us that what we create becomes meaningful to us only once we stop creating it and start to think about why we did so. The implication is clear. We could let the world wind us up and then set us to marching like mechanical dolls that go and go until they fall over because they don't have a mechanism that allows them to pause. But what would that make us less than human? We have to remember to stop because we have to stop to remember. So again, quite a lengthy article. I can give you a copy of that if you would like, but some interesting insights to evaluate how someone came in to actually looking at a day differently and evaluating along the way with the basic understanding that they had. So what we have to remember ourselves is we can remember a day, we cannot forget how to keep it, both in how we do it physically, but especially mentally. So let's go to a couple scriptures here to remember this day. In Exodus 20, let's go back to the Sabbath day command here. And once again, take a look at this with the idea that we're not just looking at it from, okay, this is one of the Ten Commandments. What's the point here, in other words? God said in verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. He didn't just say, remember the Sabbath day. There's something throughout the years that we've learned more through different messages, what it is like. What is it like? How do you keep it holy? And then he continues, the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your maidservant, nor your manservant, maidservant, cattle, stranger. So in this article, I didn't read you this part, but she said, you know, God actually put in a form of social equality all the way back then. Because, see, you did not stop work, but your manservant continued to work. God said, this is across the board, not just for this, but guess what? For your animals, too. They don't work either. And mankind has had such a battle and a fight with this to try to work this out because, for some reason, the Sabbath is seen as a day I'm missing out on getting something accomplished. So it was always the process of doing. Once again, what we see people doing all around us can get our mindset a little off the picture as well. What is our mind really on God's Sabbath day? He says, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and all the earth and the sea and all that's in them, rested the seventh day. Therefore, the God blessed the Sabbath and he made it holy. So 6 days to do our own interests, our own affairs, our own pleasures. No one else works as per the example that God gave to us from the very beginning. In Judges, you know, because the people forgot, God always allowed certain things to happen to remind them. And so many things that we see that happened in the past, we can see now as well. In Judges chapter 2 and verse 1, the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. That was God's promise. Now, they always broke the covenant with him. He says, I'll never do that. And you will make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land, but you will tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Because they were always establishing pacts with different countries. And God said, I don't want that happening. Thing is, when you bring it up to modern day age, what have we done? We've established treaties with all different countries ourselves. God said, you know something? You really don't need to do that if you would just listen and obey my voice. So we can bring this up to date in our day and age too, because some things, they happen too fast, and we don't reflect on what God said a long time ago. You know, God's delivered us, as we know, when we look at the history of warfare and what the United States has gone through because of what Abraham had done. But he says back here, you wouldn't even need to do that. You wouldn't need to be talking to the Chinese. You wouldn't need to be negotiating with the Russians. You wouldn't need to be doing that. I told you, don't do that. Therefore, I said, I will not drive them out before you, and they will be thorns in your side, and their gods will be a snare to you. Look at today. You've got all these different countries that have been thorns in our side for so long. He said this was going to happen, and it still happens in this modern day and age as well. So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel that the people lifted up their voice and they wept. So, you know, many cry tears of remorse, but few cry tears of repentance. It says in verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered up to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. Why? Why is that? You know, I wonder today why, if we ask this question, because you see the new program that's coming out that we're trying to help the parents in teaching their children, you think that relates at all? Because this is available, by the way, for the grandparents as well. For those of you that have children but can't get a book right now, you can still go online and get all the information to help to teach our children and to teach our grandchildren. But sometimes life goes by too fast, and this is not what we think of. This is what happened to them. How did you get a generation that came up that did not know God? They did not teach their children. There are ways that we can do this, by the way. Little article I pulled from back in, this was from 2000 as well, March 2000, called Making Sabbath Special. So I'd like to take a look at some of these that maybe you've already done, maybe you've incorporated, because we've talked with some others, and I looked at some of this and say, I wonder, have we done this ourselves? How You Can Make Your Sabbath Special by Celeste Perino Walker. She actually mentions first to what she calls changeover signals. She said, I found it helpful to do certain things the same way each week as a signal that the Sabbath is coming. I call them changeover signals. There are many simple things that can signal a changeover in the household, of course, for them to have their full significance. One, they must be set aside for the Sabbath use only. This doesn't have to mean an additional expense, because many of the things that can signal the changeover are already in your house. For example, you can put out clean towels, change bed sheets, put flowers on the table, or reserve a particular table for the Sabbath use. I know some of you use their kitchens during the week, but on the Sabbath day, you set your table, your dining table, and you put special candles out there. And so people have done that, and that signals that there's something special about that. Now, some people, don't forget, also get caught up in different vestiges and rituals and traditions. And you know, we found out a long time ago that there's a Jewish culture that specifically gravitates to a lot of these rituals that impressed a lot of people. You know, it doesn't have to be a Jewish ritual, because don't forget, not all Israelites were Jews. You know, I bet the Ephraimites, the Manassites, the Simeonites did something different. This is what the Jews had done. So sometimes we're asked, well, why don't you do this? We would go, because we're not. You're trying to relate us back to the Torah. The Torah is not Jewish. It's for everyone today, when you think about that, Jew or Gentile. Everyone God has made to come into this. And so there's going to be different cultures with different things. And that's fine. So now, children can have special toys they play with only on the Sabbath, and special books they read only on the Sabbath. And I'm making it available, hopefully this week I can put these on order, to have some videos available to the grandparents or the parents of children that are very good videos. I used to come home on Friday, be so exhausted. To try to prepare a Bible study for the kids was going to be a major undertaking when I was still getting ready for Sabbath and kind of finishing up things from the week. Because things can be a drain like that for all of us. So I found some of these videos, some cartoon videos that you can actually go online. I can't find them on order, but some are the series, the Hanna-Barbera series, that we allowed our kids to watch. They're a half hour each. And I know it was really enjoyable to sit down with them, to go through these videos and to say, yeah, that probably happened, that didn't happen. You know, my kids know these. Zachary and I will sit down together and we'll do the whole trailer leading up to it. You know, Derek Margot and their nomad friend Moki find themselves trapped in a whirling pool of sand, and when the dust settles, they stare up in awe at a vast chamber filled with ancient relics and artifacts from a distant time. And there, a door at the end of the tunnel. I don't have that totally right, but it's close. So, you know, we saw so many of these videos, but not to just occupy the Sabbath day, but to have a time to sit down with the kids and to go through these and to talk about them. There are other movies out there with Joseph and Jacob that some of you might already have. I'd like to make those available, that when the Sabbath time comes, you can sit down with your kids and your grandkids. You can go over some of these things, because we normally do, as we approach the Passover, some of us will pull out the Ten Commandments. You know, that movie that's gone on for such a long time, and we'll talk about those things. That's fine to do something like that, to make the Sabbath a delight, enjoyable, something that we can talk about God's laws and God's ways. There's many different ways to do that, and we're providing, again, trying to provide more information and material to make it easier for the parents and grandparents to talk about God's ways. Appeal to the five senses, she sang. She said, we had fresh flowers and candlelight. Sometimes singing. She says, on the sense of hearing, on Friday nights, we got into the habit of playing the piano and singing after we put the children to bed. Well, I know that on the way to services, we'd sing songs on the way to services and on the way back. So putting song into that. Reading the Bible. It's a good idea to consider the ages and spiritual maturity of the family, but there are many different storybooks, sections of the Bible that people can read, maybe different proverbs in reading the Bible. Singing she brings out, and she also brings out nature. In good weather, one of the most enjoyable Sabbath activities is getting out in nature to show the kids to take a walk. And some of you probably have done that, taken time to just go for walks out in nature. And this isn't just pertaining to the children, by the way. Some of us, just as couples or adults, can find a time that we can get out and just take a walk in nature and thank God for what He's done to get the world off of our backs that's been on our back for 6 days. Journaling, she said, is another one. A means of keeping a written record like a diary. The idea is to record your observations about the Sabbath, about God, and maybe about things God has shown you throughout the week. And then she also, different aspects of that. Another one is creating a blessings box. A blessings box can be made out of any kind of box, and children should be encouraged to help in whatever way they can. Use a box that has a lid. Cover the bottom and top separately with wrapping paper so you can take the top off the box without ruining the wrapping. Cut a hole into the top of the box so you can put in slips of paper. You might want to purchase a special small notepad and glue it to the side of the box so the paper will always be handy. Likewise, you can tie a pen to the string and then attach it to the box. That way no one has an excuse for not recording a blessing. During the week, each family member who receives a blessing or an answer to prayer writes it down on a slip of paper and puts it into the blessings box. At the Friday evening meal, one person reads the slips of paper out loud. Family members can take turns either by the Sabbath or by the slips of paper. Allow time for discussion and praise for each blessing. God created the Sabbath for our good. He meant it to be a blessing. So she writes of different ways and ideas that we can actually have an enjoyable time on the Sabbath day, to reflect on it a little bit better, to enjoy it, to enjoy its meaning. Over in Psalms chapter 50, sorry, in fact, let's go to, that's Psalm 50, let's Psalm 103. Psalm 103. And let's begin here in verse 2. Bless the Lord, O my soul, bless the Lord, O my soul, forget not all his benefits, who forgives your iniquities, who heals your diseases, who redeems your life from destruction, who crowns you with loving kindness and tender mercies, who satisfies your mouth with good things, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. Sometimes we forget God's blessings. The Sabbath day is one where we can be reminded and thank God about all that he's done for us. To stop for a while, to think about what he's done. And there's so many ways that we can do it. You know what makes it difficult sometimes? Is you step into your car and we travel down the interstate and you see people that are coming and going. You know, what a difference it makes, I know, from even coming over here from being in Atlanta. Because when I would cross the top of that loop and you saw all the traffic that was on Saturday, you're kind of thinking, where is everybody going? And it kind of captures you into what's called that rat trap. You know, the blessing we can have here is you come here and go, wow, we got a totally empty parking lot. Not much going on around us. It's not like we're right next to an interstate. But it causes something to happen within us and in our thinking sometimes. To where we can sit and just be quiet for a little while. To think, to anticipate. To know, hey, I'm already looking out and recognizing that there is a group of people here that already know about the Sabbath day. It wasn't my purpose to reinvent that, but to say, what are we doing with it? I myself personally would like to look at this day differently as each Sabbath approaches, as we come to Passover, to stop. It's a bit harder for me because, yes, I've got to work and I've got to preach sermons and things of that nature. But you know, there's that time that we take in our driving and going over the mountains. I'm always looking at those and noticing those and all the different creations and all the different colors. And my wife and I will take time to sing. And we had our kids with us, as we do to this day. We sang. We did things that were enjoyable. We would take a long trip and we would stop along the way, get out, we'd walk around a little bit, talk about God's ways. When I was back in Baton Rouge and I had to serve Houston, that was a five-hour drive to Houston. And by the time I got to Houston, my entire sermon was changed because I had an hour trek to Lafayette, another hour to Lake Charles, another hour into Beaumont, and then about an hour and a half into North Houston. And I meditated along the way. I stopped. I made sure I stopped early enough. Now, if I would have taken all the kids and my wife, that would have been a bit different story. 5 hours is a bit of a trek. So if we took the family, I would leave on Friday, and we get there early. But if I went by myself, meditation, singing, these are things that are enjoyable to do that all of us can incorporate. You know, there's all different kinds of wonderful music that we can use to really enjoy the Sabbath. How can I better keep the Sabbath holy? Here's some points here for us today. How can I better keep the Sabbath day holy? I'll finish with this. Number one, through prayer. Ask God to inspire you to new, exciting, and productive ideas. You know, there are idea people out there. For some of us, it's hard to come up with different ideas. When I hear an idea, I'll go, that's a good one, and I want to incorporate that. Maybe we're short on that sometimes, but there are always helpful ways to we can do it a little bit better. You know, ask God for wisdom. How do I do it better? Some have thought about that in light of even teaching or training. Some are better teachers than others. And so what's done is we have an opportunity to grab from different areas. We used to have YOU lessons, which will probably still be good. There might be some tweaking to do those, but we've got lessons that are out there for our kids and for our grandkids. There's no shortage, put it this way, of material to help us. So prayer, ask God to help us with this. Second one is preparation. Now, I've always said the best time to start preparing for the Sabbath is after tonight, after sundown, to think about what we can do better maybe for next Sabbath, to make it work out a little bit better. Oh, for instance, I know some of our lists might say, car cleaned and fueled, clothes laid out and pressed, shoes polished, briefcase ready with my notebook, my songbook, kids' items, lessons, and maybe some coloring books or other things to prepare if you've got kids at home. Food preparation. What are we having on Friday? What are we going to do? What are we going to prepare? And can it be something maybe a little bit special? How about Sabbath brunch? If you have the ability to sleep in. Sometimes I know my wife has made a certain like scrambled egg casserole that's got the potatoes and everything in it. She makes it earlier, and we just have to pop it in the oven on the Sabbath, and it makes for a really good meal. So there's not a whole lot of preparation that needs to be done with this. And of course, in the preparation, to make sure that we're thanking God along the way. The third one is, after prayer and preparation, the third one is, get to services early enough to find suitable seating. That's not a problem here. Allow time for drink, restroom, and short fellowship and prep for any organizational responsibilities. There's something that I incorporated in the past few years. I took it from years ago in the choir in Wisconsin Dells. They had something called a prelude, where before the song leader, I think the song leader, what would happen is he got up and announced that services were going to start. Could people start to find their seats? Now, do you remember all that when that's done? The song leader will get up and say, "Brethren, could you find your seats?" I remember since I've been in the church and the song leader's done that, very few action is taking place. People are finishing their conversations. And by the time the song service gets going, you find people still going to their seats. And what happens is they're not ready for the hymn that's worshiping God. And what it becomes, it trivializes the hymns. Now, I'm not trying to shake my finger at anybody. It's got to be thought out. And so what happens is I started preludes at the feast when I'm leading the choir, and it's done its job, because the song leader has gotten up there and saying, "Brethren, could you start to take your seats?" And I do the prelude. I say, "Choir, you ready?" And we start to sing. We do an a cappella song. And somebody asked me, because they liked the song, they said, "Well, could you do that during like a regular choir piece?" And I said, "Well, then it wouldn't be called a prelude. It would be called a conclude," or whatever it might be called. But I noticed, and I know it was new to Mr. Winter this year, because he said, "Well, I don't know if we..." I said, "But this will accomplish the purpose." And I noticed when we turned around, at least when I turned around, everybody was sitting down and everybody was quiet. Because, of course, they're kind of going, "What's going on right now?" No one's used to a prelude. And it serves its purpose. But the point is, for all of us, I know for myself as well, that we strive to get prepared for the worship service to start. It's easier, by the way, with smaller congregations, because it would be noticeable if somebody's still in the back talking. The fourth point is be aware and alert to others' needs as well as your own. This can apply to the Feast of Tabernacles as well, by the way, and other places that you might go. We get our own things ready, but kind of take a look around and see if somebody else may have a need as well. Be aware and alert to your own. That's the principle found in Philippians, where it says, be not just interested in your own things, but take an interest in the things of others. The fifth one is edify the body. Let our conversation be uplifting, positive, world news, Christian living. Help each other. Talk about each and, you know, how things go for you during the week. That might take a little bit of extra effort, and I think we've tried to do that within this congregation. Help each other out. It's important that we edify each other. The sixth point is glorify and revere God. Whatever we have left from the week, give it to God through our song, through our heartfelt prayer. And I tell you what, ever since we've gone through what we've done in our previous organization, when the truth started to be distorted, the ears have been a lot more attentive to prayers. Because there were used to be prayers we could not say amen to. And I know I appreciate those, the heartfelt the prayers that have gone up on behalf of the congregation. Through heartfelt prayer, through listening, through meditation, and of course through thanksgiving. That's how we glorify and revere God. Song service is a very, very important part. And there's so many things to think about when we're singing those songs, because they leave a message or they teach a story. The seventh point is, remember that this is a feast day. Leviticus 23 points that out. These are the feasts of the eternal. And he starts it out with going, this is the Sabbath day. Now, what's happened to mankind and trivelled over into God's church, by the way, is you'll know that, hey, you see most people there for the Sabbath, for the holy days, just like most people in the world now, they'll be there for Easter and Christmas. But come around to a regular worship service, you see them far and in between. This is just as important as the holy days, the Sabbath day. Remember, this is a feast day. The eighth point is, remember your family. Bible says, teach them diligently. Learn to serve them first. That was a hard job, I remember. Because if you're an extrovert like I am, and you're trying to talk to everybody, and your kids come and they pull on you and they say, "Dad, Dad," and you kind of going, I'm talking right now, and they keep pulling on you, and you don't say, you know, "Excuse me, let me address this." And again, that's a teaching tool for our kids, because there's a time not to interrupt as well. But again, I know it's time to give someone else, especially sometimes the younger ones that we tend to sometimes trivialize, to give them the attention and pay attention to them as well. Remember your own family. 9, thank God as the Sabbath draws to a close. Bible speaks about always thanking God. Thank you for this wonderful day that I can get a day of rest. Get out of this life's work, this life's thought, and just really give it to God. So I hope this has caused us maybe to take another look in the way that we view the Sabbath. Of course, I only went through some of my notes. There's a ton. There's answers about the Sabbath. Maybe we can turn this sometimes into a Bible study. What was it meant when They call it the first day of the week. They met on Saturday night. There's a lot of questions that come up that, you know, I don't want to assume that most of us might be familiar with, that we may need to review those so we can give an answer for the hope that lies within us. There's no doubt that there is a Sabbath day from the beginning to the end. And the interesting thing is it starts right out in Genesis. You know, when it ends with, we always believe that the Sabbath gives a picture of the millennial rule of Christ. So there's so many places throughout the Bible where this day is given so much importance that we can see it's a day that God caused right from the beginning. It's been observed by those that God has called all the way through the entirety of the Bible. I think he thinks it's really important, but not that we're just here to observe it, but even in the way that we think about it. Let's not forget that as we remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.